specialists, as they were called. They would not venture to the State House at all, lest their presence be distracting, and play into the Anti's hands. Sue White's plan was very different. As a native daughter, she would be right out there on the firing line, on the floor of the chambers, but she also needed Pulitzer and Graham and Flanagan to guard their assigned men, whether they were Tennesseans or not. And Miss Paul, when she arrived, would definitely want to lead the charge in the State House herself. If Paul's presence inflamed the situation, so be it, White thought. But Miss Paul must come. "Wish greatly you were here," White pleaded with Paul. "And if situation not more favorable after Republican caucus, would insist on your coming to take hold, if possible." The strategy session in Cat's room ran long and late. The apprehensive suffragists went to bed after midnight, but few could sleep. They were kept awake by singing. All through the night, the warbling voices of drunken legislators, some wearing red roses, some yellow, floated through the Hermitage hallways. The men had been enjoying themselves on the 8th floor of the hotel, where anti-lobbyists were pouring free Tennessee whiskey and old bourbon, including the local favorite, Jack Daniels in the Raw, in what came to be dubbed the Jack Daniels Suite. Chapter 17. Injustice to Womanhood. On Monday morning, Anita Pulitzer and Catherine Flanagan herded the East Tennessee Republican delegation into Nashville. They hopped off the Knoxville Special Express train ahead of their flock and silently counted straw boater-hatted heads as the men filed out of the railroad car. They made sure no one slipped away. Besides the contingent of East Division legislators, the women had rounded up an impressive collection of Republican political elders, including Alf Taylor, the newly minted gubernatorial nominee, Jesse Littleton, his defeated opponent, Congressman J. William Taylor, and former Tennessee Governor Ben Hooper, who'd long been a friend of the Tennessee Suffs. Pulitzer was flashing her most beguiling smile as reporters approached her and her group on the platform. Brushing off the dust and cinders of the locomotive smoke and the fatigue of the journey, she looked remarkably fresh and fashionable in her flower-patterned organdy dress and her black hat trimmed with cornflowers. The reporters marveled at her entourage of heavyweight Republicans, and she couldn't suppress her delight.
"These gentlemen, who do not belong to the legislature, came with us to help put suffrage over," she said, gesturing toward Hooper, Taylor, and Littleton with a grin. "They were a little shy of us when we first appeared in the mountains to solicit their aid, but now they eat out of our hands. They are suffragists."
Betty Graham puffed into Union Station on Monday morning, too, on board the overnight train carrying the Memphis and Shelby County delegation. Hers was an equally impressive constellation of West Tennessee Democrats, which included the mayor of Memphis, Rowlett Payne, Thomas Riddick, elected to the Tennessee House of Representatives, specifically to help lead ratification efforts, and Joe Hanover, who had easily regained his House seat. Charles Williams and a large League of Women Voters group were also on the train, and the Memphis region's broad enthusiasm for ratification, encouraged by Mr. Crump, was displayed by the assortment of men's civic club representatives aboard. The Rotary, Lions, Kiwanis, American Legion, and Memphis City Club had all passed resolutions supporting ratification and sent delegates to lobby in Nashville. U.S. Senator Kenneth McKellar had already arrived in the city and immediately conferred with Carrie Catt. Her observations, the state Democrats seemed weak-kneed, the governor's strength puny, and Cox ineffectual. And she was hearing more rumors about the governor's men trying to sabotage the amendment. McKellar had better break out his whip to get his party men in line, she advised. She had no illusions about how political muscle was flexed.
"I'm here to do what I can for ratification, and believe we will win," McKellar assured reporters after his consult with Catt. "There is an overwhelming sentiment in Tennessee for suffrage."
All through the weekend, porters had been cleaning and polishing, mopping floors and dusting desks, sweeping out the cobwebs of months of adjournment. Early on Monday, women took over the chores of readying the Capitol, both suffs and antis decorating the corridors with their own colors and regalia. The Capitol corridors looked more like a frenzied bazaar than any august halls of government, filled with vendors hawking their political wares. The suffs tacked yellow bunting and banners to the walls and railings. The antis lugged boxes of artificial red roses up the grand marble staircase, intended for the lapels of willing legislators and other sympathizers. Mrs. Edwin Forbes, a stately, white-haired Boston Brahmin from the Massachusetts Anti-Organization, spent the morning poised with a red rose and pin, ready to pounce on every man who entered the building. As she attempted each conquest, she would point to the banner hanging on the wall above her head, a fabric rendition of the Southern Women's Rejection League motto, "We serve that our states may live, and living, preserve the Union." Such a spectacle of women in the Capitol had never been seen before, and while some legislators were annoyed by the commotion, and others appeared befuddled, quite a few seemed to like it just fine. "Nation watches Solons, Solons watching ladies," was the headline in the day's Memphis News Scimitar, and the reporter noted that the eyes of legislators are upon the ladies, because they are fearful in wrath, and because some of them really are fair to look upon. The suffrage women who had canvassed the delegates in their home districts were assigned to watch over them in Nashville, and the diligent women tagged after their representatives at every turn. "The legislators are having the time of their gay young lives," the News Scimitar writer observed. "They like to be lobbied with and everything. There are types of feminine lobbyists with argument, looks, and style to suit the most fastidious Solon from the rural districts of the Commonwealth." At 10 o'clock, the Republicans gathered for their caucus in a Hotel Hermitage meeting room. Herschel Candler, as State Senate caucus chairman, presided, and he sat impassively as 7 state party leaders took turns putting the ratification issue squarely to the members, with varying degrees of ardor and candor. Ben Hooper, who boasted of being the first Southern governor to request his state legislature give women the vote back in 1915, led off the series of presentations, followed by a string of East Tennessee party luminaries. There were solid, practical reasons for Republicans to back ratification, they all emphasized. The party's minority position in the legislature could be worked to advantage. If the 7 state Senate Republicans and 27 party members in the House voted together as a bloc, they had the power to swing the vote in each chamber, wresting credit from the splintered Democrats and turning Tennessee into a Republican suffrage victory. Good for the fall elections. At this point, Harriet Upton, ambassador from the Republican National Committee, read aloud the telegram she had received from Harding the night before, his version of a pep talk. "You may say for me to Republican members of the General Assembly of Tennessee that it will be highly pleasing to have the Republicans of that state play their full and becoming part in consummating the constitutional grant of women's suffrage." Upton managed to read Harding's overripe prose with a straight face. "It is no longer a question of policy. It is a matter of Republican contribution to a grant of suffrage to which our party is committed, and for which our party is in the main responsible." Whatever their personal feelings or constitutional qualms, Hooper and the others told the Republicans, uniting for ratification was simply a smart move in an election year. It would put Alf Taylor in good position to defeat Roberts in November, too. When the ratification pitches were completed, Herschel Candler glanced around the room.
"You've heard those in favor. Is there anyone opposed?" he asked.
No one responded. Candler himself made no arguments, but his colleagues knew very well where he stood. Harry Byrne sat toward the back, just listened, and did not speak. He admired Herschel Candler as an excellent lawyer and a judicious man, and Byrne was reading law under Candler's tutelage. a young, ambitious East Tennessee fellow could not find a better model or mentor than Herschel Candler. And Byrne found the older man. Candler was just 40, to be unfailingly generous. Byrne was probably impressed with the way Candler was handling this awkward meeting, too, using dry chill instead of expressive heat to shape the result. The party leaders had come into the meeting aiming to nail down a unified Republican bloc to ratify, or at least a majority to pledge, but noting Candler's stony silence and the distinct lack of enthusiasm in the room, they backed off. The latest poll of the legislature's 34 Republicans counted 13 supporting ratification, 10 standing against it, and 11 still noncommittal, and few minds seem to have been changed by this morning's meeting. It was obvious that more work, more vigorous prodding, was needed. Rather than risk a negative result, the Republican leaders adjourned. They had failed. Anita Politzer was crestfallen. This was just the scenario she and Sue White had feared. There were evidently forces strong enough to embolden the antis in the Republican delegation. Without the Republicans, there was no hope for a coalition ratification majority. A telegram swiftly went out to Alice Paul in Washington. "Please come at once. We need you badly." While the Republicans were caucusing in the Hermitage, the Tennessee suffragists were attempting a unity conclave in the executive wing of the State House with Governor Roberts and his deputy, Albert Williams. The governor laid out the situation. All the different ratification committees the Democratic suffragists had created were confusing to the legislators and allowed the men to shade their ratification stances depending upon which group they were answering. There needed to be a single, unified, Democratic suff woman voice. "Enough of tribal factionalism," the governor implored. Carrie Catt could only nod in exasperated agreement. The rifts and rivalries she thought had been suppressed were back. Before the primary election, while the Roberts and anti-Roberts groups were still at loggerheads, she'd forced the heads of each ratification committee to sign a public letter forswearing any political partisanship and affirming their dedication to the single goal of ratification. Little good that had done. Now that the primary was decided, and the Roberts camp victorious, the governor's allies were keen to extract some revenge on the Luke Lee-affiliated suffs who'd plotted to defeat him. They were unwilling to deal with Abby Milton or Catherine Kenney on ratification matters any longer. A more neutral, acceptable woman must be found, the Roberts allies insisted. Ideally, someone who hadn't been tangled in the internecine suffrage feuds of the past, or the fisticuffs of the primary. That someone, the meeting agreed, was Memphis School Superintendent Charles Williams. She was the newly anointed vice chair of the Democratic National Committee and an ally of Boss Crump. Williams was named director of a new Democratic Women's Steering Committee. Catt was glad for the gesture of unity, and she was told that Williams was an able administrator and conciliator, but Williams's inexperience in high-level, high-stakes legislative maneuvering made Catt a bit nervous. Governor Roberts was pleased by the spirit of cooperation, and he promised the women he'd do everything in his power to win ratification. He just didn't tell them that Seth Walker had deserted them, double-crossed him, and made the whole ratification business much more difficult. It was up to Walker, damn him, to tell them that himself. Walker was no longer under Governor Roberts's power. Shortly past noon, Andrew Todd rapped his gavel, calling the Tennessee Senate into extraordinary session. At the same time, on the south side of the Capitol, Seth Walker pounded his gavel, bringing the House of Representatives to order. The chaplains offered prayers, and the clerks called the roll. There were quite a few empty desks, names called with no response of present, but a bare quorum was counted in each chamber, so the business of the day could begin. Thomas Riddick, Joe Hanover, and the other freshly elected members were called up to take their oaths of office, the same oath some considered to be in dire jeopardy. They raised their hands, swore to uphold the Constitution of the State of Tennessee, as well as the Constitution of the United States, and sat down. The visitor galleries above the chamber floors were packed, mostly with women, but also with a healthy sprinkling of men. The Suffs were more energetic in their decorating, draping yellow cloths and flowers around the balconies, and yellow-flowered breasts outnumbered red ones in the rows. Clusters of women filled the doorways, both on the floor level and in the balconies, and both women and men were on the floor, circulating among the desks of the legislators, defying all rules of lobbying decorum. Legislative item number one was consideration of the 19th Amendment, and the next few dealt with establishing a process for women to register to vote, pay a poll tax, and other legal requirements. In addition, there were more than 140 other issues to address, a laundry list of state and local considerations that the governor had included as a special session sweetener, enabling the legislators to return home with a little gift for their constituents. The Suffs had qualms about all these other bills on the docket, distracting the lawmakers and gumming up the works, perhaps purposefully so, but it was out of their hands. Now came the ritual pageantry, the formal transmittal of the federal amendment from the governor to the legislature. Todd and Walker each ordered the clerks of their chambers to read aloud the governor's official submission of the amendment and his accompanying message to the legislature. Both Suffs and Antis held their breath slightly as the clerks began their recitations, as neither side knew just what the governor intended to say to the lawmakers, or how strongly he would choose to say it. To the Suffs' pleasant surprise, the governor offered an exuberant argument for ratification, urging the legislature to approve the amendment promptly.
"Tennessee occupies a pivotal position on this question," he reminded the delegates. "The eyes of all America are upon us. Millions of women are looking to the Tennessee legislature to give them a voice and share in shaping the destiny of the republic."
The lawmakers had an obligation to their constituents, the governor said, but also to their state and national party platforms.
"Both parties have clearly and unequivocally declared for the ratification of this amendment," he told them. "But there is another and higher ground on which ratification may be made to depend, upon the ground of justice to the womanhood of America."
This was stronger stuff than the Suffs had expected. Roberts tackled the constitutional questions head-on, presenting the opinion of the Tennessee Attorney General that acting upon ratification was legal, and no legislator would be abrogating his oath of office. He covered all the bases, and his message conveyed a true sense of mission, even passion, a rare emotion for Albert Roberts to display.
"I submit this issue to you as perhaps the most far-reaching and momentous one on which any body of men has been called to pass since the establishment of our government."
Seth Walker listened from the speaker's leather chair, elevated on a rostrum at the front of the House chamber. Behind him was a bunting of stars and stripes, and above his head a bronze-sculpted eagle watched over the assembly. Walker listened to the governor's message without showing any emotion or agitation. Only his gray eyes moved, surveying the room, a low gaze across the floor where his colleagues sat, a flick of his vision upward to take in the partisans in the galleries. Walker was dignified and in control, methodically conducting his speakership responsibilities without a word about his change of heart. According to the rules of the legislature, after the joint resolution to consider the 19th Amendment was introduced, it would lay over in each chamber for a day, and then be referred to the appropriate committee for consideration and recommendation. But the resolution wasn't introduced into the House. The delay was blamed on a clerical error. The governor hadn't attached the actual resolution document to his message, and without that piece of paper, there was nothing to introduce. As it happens, this was a very convenient mistake for Speaker Walker, allowing him to delay the proceedings for a day, giving him extra time to quietly consolidate his forces. On the Senate side, Speaker Todd had to stall so as not to fall out of sync with the House. The only mention of ratification came when Lon McFarland brought greetings from the Maryland legislature and asked that it be read into the record. This memorial had been given to McFarland by the distinguished chairman of the Maryland Senate's Judiciary Committee, Senator George Arnold Frick, who'd led the successful effort to defeat ratification of the 19th Amendment in his state legislature, and sat in the Senate chamber this morning as McFarland's guest. The message, signed by several dozen members of the Maryland General Assembly, asked their brother legislators of the volunteer state to follow their lead in rejecting. "Do not impose the federal amendment upon your kindred southern states," the Marylanders begged. Both chambers of the General Assembly adjourned until the next morning, taking no action on ratification. The Suffs groaned quietly. Watching the proceedings, veteran Capitol Hill beat reporters privately told their fellow newspapermen, "Ratification doesn't have a chance." The State House paralysis on Monday only shifted the political action to other arenas. The door to Governor Roberts' office swung open and shut constantly, with people crossing the threshold in and out all afternoon and evening. It was during this string of entrances and exits that the Democratic ratification leaders from Memphis, McKellar and Riddick, were slammed with the news of Seth Walker's defection. Governor Roberts was forced to explain things to McKellar, who was enraged, but also adamant that Walker's turnabout not derail ratification and engender his own standing among national Democrats. McKellar and Riddick flew into action. They had to find a new legislative path before morning. McKellar made the rounds of Democratic delegates, while Riddick, still in his very first day as a member of the General Assembly, gathered together the Shelby County delegation. Before supper, he'd signed on all the Shelby representatives in the House to introduce the joint resolution on Tuesday morning. They would, as a group, take the place of Seth Walker. Roberts told his advisers, his allies, and his political friends that he'd be defeated in the fall if he didn't secure ratification for the women. They told him he'd be defeated if he did. Roberts barely had time to catch his breath, and all the message slips on his desk reading "Call Governor Cox" had accumulated into quite a pile. But there would be nothing to report until things were straightened out, in better shape. Roberts was using his time and energy to mend the gaping hole left by Walker's defection and to stop the rip from enlarging. Cox didn't need to know. Hoisting umbrellas, both Suff and anti-women moved through the rain from the Capitol building to the Hermitage and ventured into the other hotels and cafes where legislators could be found. While they were busy buttonholing and beguiling, Mrs. Catt remained in her suite at the Hermitage, and meshed in her own meetings, as both suffragist and political leaders came to consult with her. She was disturbed by the day's developments, the delay in introducing the resolution, the stalemate in the Republican caucus, and alarmed by more reports of mysterious men circulating among the legislators in the Hermitage lobby. It seemed these men did their business wearing camouflage, pretending to various names and professions. She was told they were slimy salesmen, fast-talking the legislators on the need to stymie ratification. Who sent them? No one knew. They were the sinister influences made incarnate, Catt was certain. She hand-wrote a letter to Republican National Committee Chairman Will Hayes, warning him that Republicans seemed to be mixed up in all this. She sent the letter to her office in New York to be typed and delivered directly to Hayes. She didn't want to dictate or wire this message from Nashville. It was too delicate. "Outside people have supported a campaign here against consideration of the amendment upon the ground that if the legislature takes no action, there can be no question of constitutionality or violation of oath," she told Hayes. "As many of the legislature are men of little mental training, they are confused in their thinking by the conflict of legal opinion and think no action is a safe and sane escape.
Curiously enough, the Republicans have allowed themselves to be conspicuously connected with this attempt. The failure in that morning's Republican caucus certainly seemed to bear this out. One of those outsiders was a man going by the name of Thomas Keith, who was hanging around the Hermitage and the Capitol. He said he represented the Acme newspaper syndicate, with interests in New York, Connecticut, and Vermont. He hinted that he was sent to Tennessee by the National Republican Party. His story changed daily. He talked a lot about the need to defeat the amendment. The Suffs found him suspicious enough that Cat had already engaged a private detective in New York to investigate Keith and get to the bottom of his mission. "I have a man on the job and will report when and if I can chase the thing down," Cat promised Hayes, in the hard-boiled lingo of her favorite detective novels. As the special session got underway, a deputation of anti-women from Nashville were chugging toward Ohio, on their way to confront James Cox at his Dayton estate, Trail's End. Cox's house was very different from Warren Harding's classic of American design. Cox's home was a sprawling, 20-room French Renaissance-style mansion, definitely on the showy side. When the delegation finally arrived, they were ushered into Cox's study. He'd had a hectic few days as he prepared for his first campaign swing. Warren Harding might hide all summer on his front porch, but Jimmy Cox was going out to the people, fighting for the League of Nations. Cox was consumed by meetings with his campaign staff and with Democratic Party officials. He was writing his stump speeches and recording the best ones on phonograph discs for distribution. The campaign was officially launched, and people were rallying round. 100 prominent Democratic women had already signed on to stump for the Cox-FDR ticket. Of course, if ratification failed in Democratic Tennessee, those women might not be too enthusiastic about stumping, Cox fretted. Cox was also looking forward to seeing his name up in lights. Soon, thousands of electric signs, constructed by the new Cox Electric League, a group of electrical workers around the country donating their expertise to the campaign, would blaze from windows and rooftops. The signs were the ultimate in high-tech electioneering, consisting of a circle of bulbs with an X shape of lights within. Half of the circle would be illuminated into the letter C, then the full circle would light up to spell an O, and then the X would flash out his name. This gizmo was going to make Cox a household name. Cox was also getting himself in shape for the rigors of the campaign trail by taking brisk morning rides on his stallion, the governor, galloping after rabbits for 2 hours before breakfast. He was fit and ready. He was not, however, particularly eager to meet his evening guests, the ladies of the Association Opposed and the Rejection League. The women made their case, and Cox listened for more than an hour. They asked that he use all his influence to defeat ratification in Tennessee, and if he could not promise that, he should at least stay out of the fight, exert no pressure on the legislature. Remember, they told him, states' rights was a sacred doctrine in the Democratic Party. They emphasized the states' rights rather than the woman's proper sphere arguments of the anti-arsenal, perhaps realizing that they themselves were paying a political lobbying call. Cox asked questions and engaged in a polite exchange, but he ended the meeting without revealing his decision. He bade the ladies good night. At 6 o'clock the next morning, reporters caught Cox as he mounted the governor for his morning ride. He told them he was standing pat on his decision to work for Tennessee's ratification. "Very well, then, Governor," was the anti-women's disappointed reply. This was obviously not the Democratic Party of their fathers. First Woodrow Wilson and now James Cox seemed very willing to desert the party's principles for cheap political expediency. The anti-delegation boarded the next train to Nashville, feeling miffed, but certainly not defeated. On Monday evening, in preparation for the next day's session, the Suffs approached Walker to review the latest poll of House members. That's when he revealed himself.
No, he told them. He would not be introducing or sponsoring the ratification resolution. What's more, he could not support or vote for ratification. He told them this in a very matter-of-fact fashion, as if he were explaining a sudden whim to change the color of his tie. Then he departed. Once again, he gave his dumbfounded listeners no chance to respond, much less argue. The shock waves of Walker's defection radiated outward in widening circles, knocking the Suffs off balance. Sue White and Betty Graham took it especially hard, as Walker had pledged to them personally. They had believed him. They felt like fools. In Mrs. Katz's room that night, the Suffs strategy meeting was an angry affair. They railed against Walker, but they blamed Roberts and Cox. Roberts must have known his ally was planning this trickery. Perhaps, the Suffs insinuated, he'd even encouraged it. In any case, he did not seem to be lifting a finger to stop it. And Cox surely must have known of Walker's desertion, too. He probably didn't. Roberts hadn't told him. Cat tried to calm the rattled Tennessee Suffs, focusing their attention on what needed to be done to recover. She'd experienced this type of political betrayal so many times before. She was disgusted, but she wasn't surprised. She tried to warn them, right at the outset, that this sort of underhanded thing could, and probably would, happen in Nashville. "We have long since recovered from our previous faith in the action of men based upon a love of justice," she told the Tennessee Suffs. "That is an animal that doesn't exist." It was a rough night and a raw morning for the suffragists. Anxiety invaded their sleep, as did the noisy carousing of inebriated legislators in the hallways of the Hermitage. Sue White worked deep into the night with McKellar, Riddick, and Charles Williams, crunching the latest polling numbers of legislators' pledges, which appeared to be slipping. Ann Dudley babysat the joint resolution, making sure it was drafted correctly, every T crossed and I dotted in proper legal form, lest it be challenged. She also made sure that enough fair copies were printed, so there could be no clerical mishaps again. Anita Politzer stayed up late with the Republican leaders, helping them to compose an SOS message to Harding and Hayes. Then she was back at work well before sunrise on Tuesday, dispatching anxious telegrams to Alice Paul in Washington and Abby Baker in Ohio. "Republican situation really fearful," she wired. "Hooper, Taylor, others working with me every minute. But we cannot get the men without national aid. Do not tell anyone." She surreptitiously forwarded the text of the Republicans' fresh plea to Harding, containing their bleak assessment. "There are 3 Republican senators and 11 representatives strongly against us," the Tennessee Republicans informed Harding, and named the men they knew to be pitted against ratification, including Finney Carter and Herschel Candler in the Senate, and Representatives C.F. Boyer, H.T. Byrne, and E.O. Luther. It certainly pained Politzer to see the names of the East Tennessee men she'd personally lobbied, and thought she'd pledged, appear on this roll. "They are all good party men," the Republican leaders told Harding, and they begged him to intervene. A less guarded note was sent to Will Hayes, demanding he send a strong RNC man down to Nashville. Mrs. Upton was useless. The legislators considered her just a suffragist, not a Republican. They needed a respected party man who could knock heads in Nashville. "Please keep this in absolute confidence," Politzer insisted in her wire. "We must get national pressure, or all definitely lost." By breakfast, the bleary-eyed Suffs were hit with another concussive blow from Seth Walker. He announced he intended to lead the opposition to the amendment on the House floor. He would go down the line to defeat the amendment, using his power as Speaker to bring as many House members with him as he could. And, he let it be known, he planned to refer the ratification resolution to a hostile committee. The fallout was captured in a news story. Speculation was rife as to what influence his move would have on other members of the lower body. No one had to speculate for very long. Within hours, 5 members of the House, previously pledged to ratify, were reported to have followed their speaker to the anti-side. The antis could now openly call Seth Walker their friend and champion, and chortle a bit when they did. They also received glad tidings from their co-workers in North Carolina. That state would definitely not ratify. The legislature had just convened. The governor was giving mixed, but mostly negative, signals, and the prospects for ratification were satisfyingly slim. Senator George Frick of Maryland was gleeful, telling reporters in Nashville, "If we hold Tennessee, the amendment will never be ratified. The sentiment is turning against it." At 10 o'clock, Seth Walker stood on the speaker's rostrum of the House, his left hand lifting the gavel, then swinging it down sharply to bring the session to order. In the Senate chamber, Andrew Todd went through the same motion. The senator from Murfreesboro had never been a friend of suffrage. He'd voted against limited suffrage the year before, but he'd promised local suffrage leaders and state Democratic Party officials that he'd support ratification this time, even introduce the resolution into the Senate. They had been burned by those types of vows before, so were appropriately wary. But Todd did stand up and introduce Senate Joint Resolution No. 1 that morning. In the House, Walker sat calmly in his elevated chair, while the 6 men of the Shelby County delegation rose to sponsor House Joint Resolution No. 1 in that chamber. The suffs in the galleries murmured softly with relief. Both resolutions, in accordance to the rules, were laid over until the following day. The gavels in both chambers rapped adjournment. The battle resumed outside. Betty Graham glimpsed the traitorous Seth Walker across the Hermitage lobby and headed over to challenge him. Was it true that he was going to violate his pledge to her and oppose ratification? She asked him. Walker appeared startled. People in the lobby turned to listen. Walker recovered his wits.
"I'd let the old Capitol crumble and fall from the hill before I'd vote for ratification," he said boastfully. "I'm going to do all I can to influence friends to vote no."
Summoning her dramatic talents, Graham continued the interrogation.
"What has brought about the change against the suffrage amendment in the House? The governor? Or the Louisville and Nashville Railroad?" she demanded loudly. "What kind of a crook are you, anyway? A Roberts crook or an L&N crook?"
Onlookers gasped.
"How dare you charge me with such a thing?" Walker bellowed. "That is an insult!"
Betty Graham only smiled.
"Why, I am just asking you for information," she replied in a tone of mock girlish innocence.
Visibly shaken, Walker stormed off. It was a moment of sweet revenge, but it might be costly. Reporters, scurrying around to cover the fast-breaking events, demanded Carrie Katz's reaction to Seth Walker's defection. The chief stuck to her strategy script. "You must not let the public sense weakness or the enemy smell fear." That was a lesson she'd learned long ago. She declared that her poll was unshaken.
"When I came to Tennessee 3 weeks ago, I announced that a majority of both Senate and House were pledged to vote for ratification. No development has overturned that majority," she maintained. "I have absolute confidence in the integrity of the legislators of Tennessee and believe that they will stand by their pledges."
Kat was daring the legislators to prove their integrity. But in the corridors and stairwells of the State House, and in the parlors and alcoves of the Hermitage, the suffs were learning that those pledges were not so much standing firm as keeling over. With little else to occupy their time, quite a few legislators adjourned to the Jack Daniels suite, the invitation-only speakeasy operating inside an 8th-floor room of the Hermitage, where hospitable hosts filled their glasses with forbidden liquors and filled their ears with persuasive arguments for why the Susan B. Anthony Amendment was bad for Tennessee. Tennessee had been a dry state since 1909, at least on paper, and had enthusiastically ratified the National Prohibition Amendment in 1919. Many suffs, and even some antis, ardent prohibitionists themselves, asked why the law was not being enforced on the eighth floor of the Hermitage. In Tennessee, whiskey and legislation go hand in hand, they were told, especially when controversial questions are urged. This is the Tennessee way. And Tennessee revered its traditions. Nina Pinkard, the Southern Women's Rejection League president, was standing under the graceful high arches of the Capitol's second floor, engaged in intense discussion with a legislator, when a yellow-bedecked suffragist buzzed in from behind. "Don't speak to her," the suff admonished the lawmaker, nodding dismissively toward Pinkard. "She's in the pay of the liquor interests." Mrs. Pinkard, incensed by the slur, stared hard at the offending suff, who'd already escaped down the corridor. Pinkard's rosebud lips tightened and flattened into a grimace. This was how the suffragists worked, she fumed, by innuendo and personal offense, by lies. Seth Walker might find his honorable revenge on the floor of the House, but Pinkard intended to seek a suffragist comeuppance in the newspapers and in court. She would pursue charges of criminal libel and public slander against the offending suffragist, and she warned, in a large, bold-faced notice in the Tennessean, that any suff who made similar accusations would be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. Such false and malicious charges are an example of what woman suffrage means in action, the anti-notice said. Cruel, unfair, dishonest, and unscrupulous attempts to blast the reputation of every courageous woman who dares to disagree with the politically ambitious fraction who demand votes for women and offices for women. The antis vociferously denied that any of their members had received 1 cent from any liquor or brewery interest. This charge, always circulated whenever the suffragists feel themselves beaten in a fair fight, is founded only on the malice or ignorance of little minds which assume the public can be fooled by repeated falsehoods. It was true that the suffs repeatedly accused the liquor interests. Brewers, distillers, bottlers, distributors, cork makers, hop and barley farmers, restaurateurs, and saloon keepers of financing anti-activities in almost every state, as well as in Congress. But tracing the money and the undercover political mischief was extremely difficult, forcing suffs to rely on mostly anecdotal evidence. They did uncover solid evidence that anti-suffrage advertisements and resolutions were routinely circulated in saloons, often with a free drink as reward for signing an anti-suffrage petition or voting no in a state referendum. Liquor industry workers were sent out as canvassers to warn nearby communities that their livelihood and well-being depended upon defeating woman suffrage. Liquor industry trade publications railed against suffrage. There were countless referendum election irregularities that suffs felt could be laid at the feet of the liquor interests, and their suspicions were shared by many a governor, mayor, and representative. And liquor money undoubtedly changed hands in legislative halls. But there was little solid proof. It made sense that an entire industry, threatened with destruction by dry women voters, would work to protect itself. The problem was there were scant records. These were not transactions posted neatly in any ledger. So while the suffs could competently connect the dots, they couldn't really follow the money. Their claims could be denied, even with the Jack Daniels suite in full swing. While Carrie Catt feigned calm confidence, a more honest hysteria gripped Sue White and her Woman's Party comrades. Telephone and telegraph wires strung between the triangle of Nashville, Washington, and Ohio pulsed with bulletins of alarm. Pulitzer's Before Dawn telegram set Alice Paul on edge. The master micromanager was impatient with a lack of detailed information and frustrated by the limitations of commanding her forces at such a remove. but she couldn't afford to leave Washington, not until enough money was raised to cover her expenses and keep things going in her absence. Every rich woman she'd tried to put the touch on was away on vacation. She was reduced to asking her board members to pass the hat at their posh summer colonies in Maine and Rhode Island. She kept putting off her departure for Nashville. "What was going on down there?" Paul demanded of Sue White in a testy mid-morning telegram, sent while White was in the State House gallery. "We find it impossible to give help on Tennessee from this end, as we have no information about Democratic attitude," Paul scolded. She demanded some basic info. "Do we have a majority? Do you expect success? When will the measure come to a vote? Is there any evidence of Cox's promised efforts on behalf of ratification?" "Please do not spare money on telegrams," Paul chided White. Miss Sue was always carefully frugal, but that wasn't the only reason she'd not sent better reports. She had zero time to write any cogent analysis. But she also didn't know what to say. Tell Miss Paul that she'd lost control of the campaign? Explain that support for ratification was mysteriously evaporating? All on her watch? Not unlike Governor Roberts, White had been stalling for time, hoping to set things right before having to give a full accounting. Seth Walker had smashed her strategy, too. The hottest gossip around Nashville on Tuesday was not the many rumors of defections and double crosses, or even the many elaborate conspiracy theories, though they were definitely swirling around, but Betty Graham's fiery confrontation with Seth Walker earlier in the day. The militant Oregonian had insulted the speaker, Walker's friends complained, questioned his integrity, and besmirched his honor. "Her language was offensive," one newspaper reported, "and the aftermath is a show of deep offense at the suffragists by Mr. Walker's friends, who are numerous in Nashville, both among the members and the residents." Graham must apologize, Walker's friends insisted. Graham had no intention of apologizing. "We are not going to be thrust aside easily," she said defiantly. "Some sinister underground influence is at work here. We are entitled to know just who is changing a majority to a minority. I rely on Alice Paul to uncover the real reason for the backset of our hopes here," Graham said. "If the liquor interests or the Louisville and Nashville Railroad are responsible, she will find it out." Graham's sisters in the Woman's Party were quietly thrilled by her nervy tackle of Walker, and even Carrie Catt would have to admit that the youthful provocateur was simply saying aloud what Catt herself was thinking. But the Tennessee suffs were mortified by Graham's actions. This was just the kind of unladylike behavior that gave ammunition to the antis, proving their predictions of the horrible sex wars that would attend suffrage and women's entry into politics. The Southern suffragists had methodically fought against this stereotype for years, and they didn't have to wait long to feel the fallout. Following his morning clash with Graham, Walker began a vigorous opposition to ratification, the newspapers reported, while his friends are irate over the militant policy here as a result of the speaker's defection. Tom Riddick, always admirably blunt, applauded Graham's moxie and thought it might even do some good.
"It will smoke out Seth Walker," he said, "and tell those confounded women to stop their cackle."
It was assumed he meant the antis. By late Tuesday afternoon, when Alice Paul finally connected by telephone with her lieutenants in Nashville, they relayed the unfolding bad news. Seth Walker was working strenuously to peel away pledged votes. More legislators were suddenly altering their positions. "We are losing men right straight along." Thomas Riddick barged into Governor Roberts' office and shut the door. Never a man to mince his words, he could slash a man to ribbons in the courtroom, Riddick told Roberts that suspicions about his sincerity and commitment were undermining the ratification campaign among legislators. People were saying that the governor was deliberately dragging his feet. The Suff women did not trust him, and Roberts' own men were fomenting trouble. Riddick delivered an ultimatum. If ratification failed in the legislature, if Democrats were shamed, Roberts's re-election was doomed. This was, of course, the exact opposite of what Roberts was hearing from his advisors. Roberts protested, telling Riddick that he would be not only humiliated but crushed if ratification did not pass. He was in the ratification fight wholeheartedly, and in it to win. He vowed to bring pressure upon any straying friends and asked for the names of doubtful members, promising to go to work on them immediately. While Riddick was browbeating the governor, almost 100 Tennessee Suff women were conferring with about a dozen Democratic senators at the State House. Quite a few invited senators decided not to show. Responding to the furor over Betty Graham's public shaming of Seth Walker, Charles Williams assured the senators that the Suffs had no intention of trying to dictate their actions, and she soothed them by saying that the women willingly placed their cause in the hands of the men, relying upon their sense of justice and fair play. If this smacked a bit too much of the type of female soft suasion historically favored by those opposed to woman suffrage, and if it echoed the anti's willingness to put decision-making in the hands of men, or if it brought to mind the classic image of the Southern woman on her pedestal, protected by her adoring menfolk, Charles Williams calculated that it was a necessary accommodation. It might not jibe with Mrs. Katz's admonition that a political man motivated by justice was an imaginary animal, but it was not, Miss Williams would insist, a capitulation. If it eased the minds of the senators and smoothed the path toward ratification, it was a worthwhile compromise. By evening, Seth Walker had constructed a sturdy rationale for his revised ratification stance.
"I have become convinced that it is my duty to my state and to my constituents to oppose this thing," he explained to a sympathetic reporter. "There's no question in my mind that a large majority of the people, both men and women in Tennessee, are against universal suffrage from principles, or are violently opposed to action through a federal amendment. The cities, no doubt, would vote for suffrage, but by no great majority, while the rural sections, which predominate in Tennessee, I know are strong against this ratification."
Walker was relaxed and expansive with the reporter for the Anti-Standard, the Chattanooga Times, feeling well satisfied with the day's accomplishments.
"The method is wrong from every angle, as I view it, especially from the standpoint of the South," Walker explained. "Tennessee has it in its power now to thrust upon every other state, whether agreeable to the people thereof or not, equal suffrage, and to enfranchise all elements of women. It is too much power to be wielded by a single state, especially since the present representatives have not been instructed in any way regarding it."
Whether he consciously recognized it or not, Walker had just articulated, in vivid summary, every argument the antis were advancing in Nashville. Walker said he realized that his patron, the governor, was favorable to ratification and stood ready to push its passage through the legislature. But, Walker hinted, Roberts was only following orders from Democratic bigwigs.
"I believe his stand is due to a sense of duty to the National Party organization, which seems determined that Tennessee shall ratify," Walker claimed, making Roberts appear to be both a victim and a puppet. "My action is entirely independent, and there is no break between myself and the governor."
This statement was also no favor to Roberts, making it seem as if a little matter such as betrayal of the suffragists and defeat of the amendment was no reason for discord between good buddies. It was just politics.
"I think he will accord me full credit for acting as my own conscience dictates," Walker said of Roberts, "if I am placed in the position of refusing to vote as he may possibly ask me."
While Walker was giving fair warning to the governor, don't ask me to relent, and celebrating the purity of his own conscience, he did not attempt to explain the suddenness of his change of conviction, nor did he bother to mention his legal work for railroad interests. He especially avoided any reference to whispers that a lucrative railroad position had been dangled before him as a reward for his opposition to ratification. Seth Walker was making Tennessee's junior U.S. Senator Kenneth McKellar's job much harder, but McKellar kept at it all evening and into the night. He set up an office in his room at the Hermitage, loosened his tie, scrutinized the handwritten list he'd made containing the names of uncommitted or wavering Senate Democrats, and summoned each man to his room, one by one. What he said to them, what he promised them, how he threatened them, we do not know. He probably brandished both carrots and sticks, offered both sugar and vinegar. But by late Tuesday night, he could announce that 15 Democratic senators had committed to voting for ratification. They made that promise to his face, gave him their solemn word. He would remember any man who reneged. While McKellar was twisting arms in his Hermitage room, Judge Joseph Higgins, president of the Tennessee Constitutional League, was warning legislators that they dared not ratify the amendment. Should they be tempted to bow to suffragist pressure to ratify, Higgins explained, his organization would be constrained to go into the courts and inhibit the Secretary of State from certifying the amendment. It was no idle threat. The League lawyers were already drafting the injunction papers, and it was a powerful one, promising both parties a disastrous fall of electoral chaos, putting the results of all contests, including presidential, into question. Following the day's long string of fraught phone calls from Nashville, Alice Paul sent Abby Baker to see Cox again. "Do something," she implored. Cox had sent another anodyne message to the Tennessee legislators through Charles Williams, and his efforts appeared lackluster at best. In her visit, Baker discovered one reason why. "Cox appears worried," Baker reported confidentially to Paul. His aides were telling him that women will double the Republican vote in Ohio and cause loss of state. The first wave of the great migration of Southern black families into Ohio during the war had augmented the Republican voter rolls, and the votes of black women could only exacerbate the Democrats' problems in the state. Perhaps it was best not to push Tennessee, his aides were urging. Cox did, however, promise Baker that if Governor Roberts persisted in refusing to telephone him, he would call Roberts himself and demand a frank and detailed report. Alice Paul had had enough. On Tuesday night, she issued a blistering statement. "The majority for ratification of the suffrage amendment in the Tennessee legislature has disappeared," she howled. Speaker Seth Walker's desertion was highlighted. "The change in the Tennessee situation can be traced to one thing only. The failure of Governor Cox and Governor Roberts of Tennessee to put sufficient force behind their public pleas for ratification to ensure a favorable action," she accused. "Defeat of the amendment in Tennessee would be a deliberate defeat." Paul bitterly challenged Cox and Roberts, as she had Woodrow Wilson and so many other waffling politicians. "Deeds, not words." Chapter 18. Terrorizing Tennessee Manhood. It was a stunning opening gambit. As soon as the chaplain finished his prayer on Wednesday morning, House Majority Leader William Bond rose from his seat. Bond was a friend of Seth Walker's, just a few years older than the speaker, and they'd worked closely together to push through Governor Roberts's legislative agenda. They were both ambitious young lawyers forging political careers, and together they launched a meticulously orchestrated ploy. Speaker Walker recognized Bond. He wished to introduce House Joint Resolution Number 4. "Proceed," replied the speaker.
"Whereas,"
Bond read from the paper in his hand, as the floor and galleries suddenly went silent, heads tilted, ears strained. Bond's first set of 6 or 7 whereas pronouncements provided a history lesson, a pointed reminder of why the Tennessee Constitution contained that